I wonder if I might just ask you a brief question. You said after the crash and after the ensuing economic disaster known as the Great Depression, you mentioned that those cars never came back. How come? That may seem.
Well, I don't know. They were too big and so forth, and the people began to not have chauffeurs and.
You didn't need them anymore. They started doing their own driving.
So they started doing their own driving, and we used to have customers. For instance, there was a fellow down in Buffalo. He'd come from down in the Pennsylvania oil country, and he had four Rolls Royces and two chauffeurs, and he'd go by his place. I was always real impressed because he had a garage there, and the boss chauffeur lived upstairs with his family. And when he'd go by there and the doors were open, there were these four Rolls Royce, beautiful radiator, all backed in, you know, facing out, you know, and he had the doors open, and here were the four Rolls Royces. And he was an elderly man and had a chauffeur. And the thing about it, those in the Rolls Royce in those days, I don't know how it is right now, but those chauffeurs had to know how to service the car. They didn't take it into a dealer.
A chauffeur really meant that he was a mechanic.
And this fella had a hoist and a place to change the oil and all this and that, and grind the valves. And
it was an honorable
It wasn't profession. Just a guy that drove the car into the dealers and said, do this.
Well, obviously, the custom car business was one of the first businesses to be hit by the fact that people had lost millions of dollars, some thousands, some hundreds of thousands, some in some cases millions. So the obvious corollary is that the custom car business began to slowly decline, in some cases precipitately decline, right? What happened to Brunn? What was their history?
As Mr. Webber used to say, he was trying to get my father to liquidate along in 1931 and two.
Yeah.
Hang on to all the money they'd made, but he wouldn't do it. And fortunately, in that period between 1929 and 1939, when we did our best work, because the chassis permitted it, the chassis had been redesigned by the engineers. This is when I learned the business, really.
You really had to hunker down and
because
cut personnel.
We had chassis like those to work on. And
what were they?
Well, I mean, like that second one over there, and the 145-inch chassis wheelbases, that 145-inch wheelbase chassis that gave you something that you could design a car on, an imposing car and a comfortable car.
Well, from the standpoint of internal situation, where you wanted to keep your key people together, you'd made a lot of money during the 20s, a fairly good amount of money. So you just sort of had to sort of retrench and cut expenses.
And lay off,
yeah.
At the highest peak, we had 150 people working, and I think at the last there, we had 50 working.
Wow. Those 50 were key personnel, were they not? They were here.
Well, they were key personnel in the sense that they were the most skilled that we had. We had a lot of skilled people.
Right, exactly.
There wasn't anything in that plant of ours that couldn't be done, whether it was making a toy Ford for me or propping up the Christmas tree or printing or painting the, for instance, in 1928, John N. Willys was made ambassador to Poland. And we were building bodies at that time on Stern's Knight, which was owned by Willys. And he had a cabriolet made to take over there to Poland with him. And we had a painter there that was a great artist, and he painted the great seal of the State Department of the United States on both doors. And we had people that could could do all that kind of stuff.
And yet, in spite of all your best efforts, things still got worse, right?
Yeah, the people just weren't buying it.
Yeah. It was obviously a case of not having a market out there anymore. The market almost disappeared, didn't it?
Yeah, and you had to lay these off, and like, for instance, that's how a number of the fellas got up, I was going to say up here, but I mean up to Detroit. They finally straggled down up there and got in with Fisher Body and worked there for the rest of their lives, eh?
Specifically, in the case of Brunt, if we use it as a convenient case history, what did your father do in terms, did he try to hang on to as much of the market as he could command?
Well, he tried to design things that he thought would be saleable. Now, the last really creative thing we did was that Turing Cabriolet.
Describe that in audio terms, if you would. Which one is that?
Well, the last
creative,
real creative thing we did was that Turing Cabriolet there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just laid out so that it could be used by either owner or chauffeur. There was a partition in between the front compartment and the rear compartment. The top folded down, the rear quarter top folded down, cabriolet fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a car that could be driven either by the owner, or if they wanted to have the chauffeur drive, they put the family or the party in the back and cranked up the partition glass, and then they had the privacy back there.
This still featured your famous all-weather cabriolet device for the chauffeur's car compartment.
Now, this had something that I don't think people really appreciated. Skylights on the front. We designed those skylights in there and tinted glass, and when you pulled up to a traffic signal, you weren't bending down to see what it was. All you did was look up through that tinted glass, and there was the traffic signal.
Now, where was that located?
Right in the front of the windshield.
Front of the windshield. Oh, you had a sort of a traffic signal reflector.
No, it wasn't a reflector. It was a glass.
That was.
You also had visors, bigger visors on it.
That was specifically aimed at the angle of the traffic signal in front of you.
Well, you just looked up instead of crouching down.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why that happened.
According to your account, Mr. Brunt, at this point, your father, in desperation, began to turn to another innovation. What was something you've called the alteration period? Tell us a bit about
that.
Well,
this was, this was grasping for straws.
Exactly.
And, here's a story. The Buick historian devotes a whole chapter to it. A fellow by the name of Terry Dunham, who worked for Pontiac but was a Buick fan.
Well, tell us your impression of what happened as you went through it.
Well, here's what happened. Mr. Curtis, Arlo Curtis, who at that time was general manager of Buick.
In the early 30s?
In Flint. When?
What year would this have been, roughly?
This would have been 1938, 39.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they had a big car, what they called a Limited.
Right. Great famous car. Buick Limited, yes.
And he wanted to have custom coachwork built on the Limited to compete with Cadillac, and he wanted it built, expected it to be built by Fleetwood.
Mm-hmm.
But the Cadillac people swung so much weight in the corporation that the board of directors said, no, nobody can have any custom coachwork except Cadillac.
Yeah, right.
So the chief body engineer at that time was a fellow named Ed Ragsdale, who, by the way, later on became general manager of Buick right after Carlo Curtis. But anyway, he had known Brenn. There's one of them. That was a town car hacked out of.
But you're ahead of your story. What?
Hacked out of a Limited.
Yeah, tell us about how Ragsdale was the one who...
Ragsdale said, well, if they won't do it, let's go outside. He said, I used to work on the Pure Cerro in Buffalo, and I know Brenn down there. Why don't we try Brenn?
As a matter of fact, Brenn did some Pure Cerro bodies very early on.
Oh, we built quite a few Pure Cerro bodies right in our hometown.
Yeah.
And so we got word to come on up there, and my father was not well at that time, and Victor and I went up there and...
Victor Lang.
Yeah, we talked the thing over and came back with the information that was needed to design a whole custom series like Lincoln had.
Mm-hmm.
Touring Cabriolet, all-weather Cabriolet, town car, or Brougham, and things like that. And I worked on drawings like that. We went up there and all of a sudden, the war was coming on then too, anyway. And they got another, Mr. Curtis got slapped down. They had picked out all four or five jobs. No, you can't do it. But they did put out a catalog showing the red rings and so forth, and said, well, we could get business from the dealers.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
We built two. That one there for Colonel Bordeaux down in Florida, and another one for a touring cabriolet on the Buick Limited for Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune.
Really? This one that you've alluded to is a stretched out Buick Limited body or chassis.
Yeah, that's the job for this Colonel Bordeaux from down in Palm Beach.
How do you spell his last name, you remember?
Huh?
How do you spell Colonel Bordeaux's last name?
B-E-R-D-E-A-U, I believe.
And this was his personal car. This is the one-off, right?
That's the one-off, no.
Mm-hmm. And does that still exist today?
Hmm?
Does it still exist today?
I don't know.
Let me take it.
I don't know. I have no idea. That showed up.
This was taken... This is the Cabriolet with the familiar irons on the rear quarter.
That did not fall down.
It was a phony, in other words. Okay.
What the French call a faux cabriolet.
A faux cabriolet.
False cabriolet.
Yeah, right. Now this was taken in front of Henry Ford Museum.
No, that's in front of Augustus College, the Buffalo State Teachers College.
That looks very familiar. Where was that again?
Buffalo State Teachers College.
Buffalo State Teachers College. Actually, it came out of the shop.
Yeah.
I see. So
before we delivered it.
Looks very familiar. So, but that that was a stopgap, which showed some progress.
Well, there was two there. Then we made a couple of convertible jobs for them. Or maybe for them. Maybe you saw it in here.
Yeah.
Flipping out of the New Yorker magazine.
Now, can you describe that in oral terms?
Well, it was a convertible design, and it had a fast line sloping from front to rear.
What year was it again? What was the basic chassis body?
What did it say up there?
Well, that was a 1941 Buick Roadmaster convertible.
Yeah, it's taken from we took a Roadmaster car and cut it up.
Yeah.
Hacked it down like that.
You did what?
Hacked it up like that.
What do you mean by hacked it up?
Well, you know, that we cut the sides down like this and we added this molding. And
this check molding?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, incidentally, this was the first Buick to have a power top on a convertible.
Really? How did it work?
Well, it worked fine, though.
Now, what was the motive power? Electric?
Yeah.
Or hydraulic?
No, this was not hydraulic. Trico tried some of those.
Yeah. Who tried some of those?
Trico, you know, the windshield wiper company in
Buffalo. Did they, before they got into windshield wipers or after? Pardon? TRICO. They tried hydraulic Convertible tops.
Well, they tried everything on hydraulic, but first was the wipers.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Well, we knew them quite well. John O'Shea, the president of the thing, used to be a ticket taker at Shea's Theater. The Tech Theater there in Buffalo. And they,
really? Tech?
Yeah, the Buffalo Tech Theater.
T-E-C-H?
T-E-C-K.
T-E-C-K?
It was a legitimate theater in Buffalo.
What was his last name again? How did you spell it?
O'Shea. S-H-E-I. They're very prominent. I don't know whether they're... I imagine the Shies are all dead. I don't even know whether Trico was in business. They had a big business going with General Motors. They furnished all the wipers practically for General Motors.
For years.
And they became very wealthy in plants in Europe and all over.
They certainly have the replacement market pretty well set up still. The wiper replacement market.
Well, the blade itself, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. But you say they were originally powered by hydraulics, and they did hydraulic power tops as well?
Well, hydraulic power top caused you to have to start the engine in the car and develop the hydraulic power that way by the running the engine, whereas an electric one didn't. There was the same problem on the wipers. I don't know whether you ever experienced it, but sometimes you've been in a rainstorm with a hydraulic wiper and you start going uphill and it was raining real hard and the wiper would begin to slow down because you were draining the,
right.
the hydraulic power.
Power, so. Yeah, that's right. But this particular car was a hacked up 41 Buick Roadmaster convertible.
Cobbled
is a nice word. Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. In the bodybuilding business.
Yeah.
On the line, you call them hacked up, but you mean cobbled together. Yeah.
That was a sample, and then there was another one, but nothing ever came of it.
Let me just read this description, which is interesting.
Well, that was written by somebody in.
From the New Yorker, he says, up on the mezzanine, I rent. Would it have been an automobile show?
This was at the Grand Central Palace in New York.
In New York, okay. That's
you know where the Grand Central Palace was?
No.
Well, it was attached to the Grand Central Station.
The water on the side?
No, you went in on Lexington Avenue.
Yeah, been there.
And for down, I don't know whether that's north or south or whatever it is, from 42nd Street.
Mm-hmm, right. And where would it be? In the Grand Concourse area there?
No, it wasn't in the station. It was attached to the station, a separate building.
To the right, maybe, or the left. But...
Yeah.
Well, this Grand Central
Palace was where they held their auto shows for years.
For years, after the Hotel Astor no longer... Well, no, the Hotel Astor had them for a long time.
Pardon?
Well, there's separate ones at the Hotel Astor's.
Well, salons at the Hotel Astor.
Salons, not shows.
They gave up at the Commodore, but not the regular auto show.
Okay. So this commentator from the New Yorker apparently is attending the 1941 show, the show in 1940 for the 41 models, and he sees the Brennan Company cobbled together 41 Buick Roadmaster convertible, and he says, up on the mezzanine, I ran across a Buick Roadmaster convertible, which seemed to me to forecast a whole new range of ideas in color styles.
Well, that was a nice compliment. That's why I made that up.
Exactly. Its body by Brun is painted a rich cinnamon brown, and along each side there is a streak of light yellow in the shape of a shallow V, which goes from radiator to rear. The V hitting its peak, or nadir, just at the fender line, and then coming up again across the rear wheel housing.
It's difficult to describe.
Yes, it is.
Right.
The sides of the body, back of each door, are cut away in a smaller V, right, which is a continuation of the original, whose contour follows the streak of color. The upholstery is tan cord, trimmed with leather, built only on order. It will cost you about $3,500, which was in those days quite a sum. But today you can't get a Yugo for $3,500.
No, you can't get a Yugo, you can't get anything.
That's marvelous. Well,
as I remember, like all these big 12-cylinder Lincolns, they were down cars and things like that. They ran about $7,000, you know, and that was thought to be a hell of a price.
Well, you and your father are struggling during the 30s to try to keep things together running
companies. Well, his theory was to do is, if you design good-looking cars and practical cars, well, you're going to get business and to sell them, but that was not so anymore.
You really had to resort to heroic measures to try to keep a sense of, to try to keep your head above water and try to design something that you could live with.
Yeah,
in terms of
there was
standards.
A 2-year period there, just before they agreed on liquidation, when my father hadn't got a nickel out of that company. Everybody else did, but
according to your own account, their profits stopped.
Right?
The profits never really resumed.
No, the profits never really resumed.
So you were living on capital in a sense.
Yeah. Everybody else got paid, but I remember my mother saying, don't you think they could spare you $25 down there or something like that?
Now, what had happened in the finance end? Was Mr., what was the gentleman's name?
Webner.
Webner? What happened? Did he stay on in finance?
He and I liquidated the place.
Okay, he was still an officer of the company.
Yes, I was elected vice president because he decided that the company had only had one president and they wouldn't have another one. And he and I went through the liquidating. We got the money and paid off the creditors and put the rest in the bank. And I came up to Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say the Touring Cabriolet, which was your last creative effort in terms of something that was uniquely Brun. Although you sold a number of them to celebrities and to people who still had money in terms of film stars, you mentioned Katharine Hepburn and other people who had at least were making money at the time and wanted something well built and prestigious.
Yeah, but you see, when they gave you an order for 30 of those,
yeah,
price agreed upon, and if the customer wanted anything else done, alterations or anything, well, that was extra, but otherwise when you got the order for the 30, they were $3,000 a piece for the body or something like that.
That was it?
Yeah.
What if they wanted extra? Would you charge the dealer extra or the
extra what?
Extra what? Suppose they wanted extra appointments or extra...
Yeah, well, we charged.
You would charge the dealer your usual...
Well, the customer, we just would...
Work with the customer, then?
No, this was... When these orders for these, which came through Lincoln Dealers, they just sent the order to Dearborn, and they turned around and sent to us what they call an ISO, an irregular specification
order.
Mm-hmm. And if there was anything different, why, we figured it out, or they'd called up and said, well, they want vanity cases now, like one man there wanted a speedometer. He was ordering two, a speedometer on the back of the front seat, so he could see how
sure.
fast he's going. Well,
how fast the chauffeur was going.
Yeah, so that's yeah. That was an extra item.
But you charge for that, of course.
Yeah.
I'm going down to four.
All right, do you want me to...
Just let me see if she gets down at home.
Well, there's one thing I want to...
Oh, please, yes, go ahead.
One thing I want to emphasize here is that, I was the boss's son.
Yes.
The boss expected and demanded more conscientious application to my job than anybody else in the place.
There you are.
No, you know who that is?
Who's that? Howard Hughes?
No, that's Ralph Pulitzer.
Who's that, Ralph Pulitzer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a Cadillac dealer in Great Neck, New York.
Was he really?
I mean, you know, the financial. This is a young fella.
Yeah.
Junior.
Junior? He was a Cadillac dealer?
Pardon?
He was a Cadillac dealer, did you say?
Yeah, he owned the dealership. I don't know what it was called, but.
In somewhere in New York?
Great Neck, Long Island.
Great Neck, okay. But this is your place in Buffalo.
Yeah, well, that was when he took delivery of it.
Now, Brun & Company was on 986 West Street.
Ellicott.
Spelled.
Ellicott, E-L-L-I-C-O-T-T.
Ellicott Street, and you were there for a number of years. Or was that your showroom?
Pardon?
Showroom and factory?
Excuse me, no, I didn't get it.
Is 986 your showroom and factory?
That's the showroom, and that's the front door, and the factory was in the back. The driveway was down to your right.
So when prominent buyers, dealers, or customers would want to pick up their customized run car, they'd come up to Buffalo sometimes.
Yeah, but generally we ship it to them.
Yeah.
Or they would send out like for J.P. Morgan. We built a job for J.P. Morgan on a 1938 Lincoln.
That's right.
And he had a chauffeur, guard, lifeguard, a security man by the name of Charlie's name. Well, anyway, he was the chauffeur and guard and so forth, bodyguard and so forth.
Right.
And he, we never saw Mr. Morgan. We did all the business with Morgan's car through Charlie Robertson.
Charlie Robertson.
Who was the chauffeur and the bodyguard. Mm-hmm. Never dressed like a chauffeur. Most of our chauffeurs did not.
No. No livery.
Once in a while, I think in the evening, they might wear a cap, but they always generally had a gabardine suit on, and snap brim hat, you know, because they frequently went into the stores with the people, you know, and they didn't have any uniform on. Charlie didn't. He knew what the boss wanted, and this was an extra headroom job, and he came up with the salesman from Great Neck Motors. This is Lincoln dealer. And they drove the car back together down to New York, and the dealer wanted to make sure it was all tuned up, you know. And, I have to laugh. Mr. Morgan left this fellow quite a lot of money, and he went into politics, and he became sheriff of whatever county Manhasset, Long Island is in.
Really?
Yeah.
Suffolk, huh?
Huh?
Suffolk?
Isn't that what it is? I don't know. The town was a Manhasset, I know.
All of which reminds me, were you sad to see that the Royal car was sold at auction?
Which Royal car?
The 1939 Royal car. Was that a Brun?
Oh, no. Where did you see this?
The one that was in, that's been in the Henry Ford Museum.
No, that was not our car. That was a LeBaron.
That was a LeBaron.
I'll tell you why.
Why? What happened?
Well, you got notice, such short notice, to get a car. This is King George VI.
From whom? Who did you get the notice from?
George Walker, the purchasing department at Lincoln.
Right, okay. About 1938, right?
I had to have it in 6 weeks. Well, we couldn't possibly do it in 6 weeks, but LeBaron, we got together, and Ralph Roberts got together with us. They were building a four-door convertible sedan. So all Ralph Roberts did was take the body and build on a town car upper structure.
Right.
They didn't have to do anything except take the convertible body without paint and everything or anything on it, just all stamped and put together. And then they built the roof on up there, and they put a shield up in front, as I remember, and they got it done in time.
Did you try? Was Brun working on a prototype? Or did you decide not to enter the competition?
No, it wasn't a competition. It was just being a town car. George Walker, George thought it was
perfect for you guys.
It was perfect for us fellas, but we couldn't get it done in 6 weeks. It generally took 2-3 months.
Did you say?
And this had to be. I think the rear quarter had to be folding, and it was high and
This. Did you say Ralph Roberts came down to talk to you about it?
Well, he didn't come down. I think we had some telephone conversations.
He was head designer at LeBaron at that time. Yeah. I'm fascinated by your father. Tell me a bit about him. What was he? What kind of a gentleman was he?
Well, the best father in the world.
Was he?
Oh, yes.
In what ways? Was he attentive as a father, a loving...
Yeah, very much so, and also he and I were great pals.
That's good.
We were interested in the same kind of athletics. He got me started in track and field, and go to the track meets, and he'd come over to the armies when we were training in the afternoon and provide cars for the high school track team to go down to Alfred University or Colgate University. I thought it was the most important way to keep me out of trouble was to get me wrapped up in something like that, and it was, and I still believe it.
Right. It was your salvation, in a sense, that he got you into the car business.
Well, another thing that he did that helped me a lot, even after I got to working up there at Lincoln and Ford, I knew all those people almost.
That's marvelous, yeah.
I mean, like... body engineers and George Walker and purchasing and
do you remember Mr. W.C. Cowling? Did you meet him?
Yes, he's right there. He's a salesman. He was a general Ford salesman. Yeah. Ford general salesman.
Was he a good man to talk with?
Well, I only talked with him once this time right here. He didn't. Mr. Hatch was Lincoln.
That's right. Man, what was Hatch's first name again?
Arthur.
Arthur Hatch. He was the Lincoln salesman.
Yeah, he was the one that we knew the best. But of course, he reported to Cowling.
Cowling had a rather, even though he was there about 10 years, he had a rather checkered career.
Is that so?
Ford, the elder Mr. Ford didn't like him too well.
That's so.
But Ezel thought he was pretty good. So
Mr. Hatch, up until 2 years ago, lived out in San Francisco.
Did he really?
On Broadway, up at 1990 Broadway.
Oh.
He died up there, way up to the top of the hill there, going up towards the big cathedral.
Uh-huh.
Up there on the top of the hill.
Mm. Which hill was that?
Well, on California Street, and you know where the Mark Hopkins is? Mark Hopkins Hotel?
Telegraph?
No, it's on California Street. And that Episcopal Cathedral is up there, that big Episcopal Cathedral.
Your father, what about his father? You talk about his uncle, but what about his father, your grandfather?
Well, my grandfather, and on that one side, they came from Bavaria in 1848. And I think my grandfather was 19 or something, and he immediately became a United States citizen, evidently because he voted for Abraham Lincoln the first time. And they came from Bavaria to escape military service of Mad King Ludwig.
Yes, right, yes.
Well, that's the
Universal military conscription is what he introduced.
Yeah,
but, yeah, right.
They came to miss that. And the first thing they did when they became citizens is join the Union Army and fight through the Civil War.
Good for them, yeah.
And, it's interesting, there were 14 of them, including the grandmother, that came over, and my grandfather was the second youngest. Uncle Henry, the carriage baker, he was the youngest. And there were then 12, 13, and the grandmother, who was 94, she came. She died. It took them 6 weeks to get over, and she died at sea and was buried at sea.
Mm.
And it always makes me want to kick myself around the block that I didn't find out more about them. They came from Spire.
Spire, S-P.
Small town on the Rhine.
S-P, how do you spell it?
Pardon?
How do you spell Spire?
S-P-E-Y-E-R.
Okay.
There is a big cathedral there which runs back with tombs of the Bavarian kings and so forth. And it's famous for its Romanesque architecture. Romanesque architecture has the arches,
mm-hmm.
round arches, where Gothic has the pointed arches.
Right.
And only thing my father told me once is he remembers his father sitting down there all around the table putting his finger on the Niagara frontier, and he said, here's the place we're going to go, because that's supposed to, that will someday become a big industrial area.
He was right.
Yeah, and but some stayed in Buffalo and the rest of them scattered around. I think there's some in, some went to Minnesota. And then my grandmother, although she was of German extraction, she was born in this country down in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Mm.
So that's the only German connection, really.
Your father, did he have a mechanical bent?
No. He didn't have a mechanical bent, or he didn't even want to mow the lawn. I had to do that. All he wanted to do was sit in there and make drawings.
So he really wanted to design more than anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, indicative.
But
of that,
we were very fortunate because of the employees we had in that shop. They, as I said before, they could do anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted some new cupboards put in, Otto came over and put them in. If you wanted
that. Who was that?
Otto, he was one of the workmen over there, and they were all very skilled fellows and excellent workmen at their jobs and almost anything you asked them to do.
Mm-hmm. What, there was a passage that I was looking at, and the excellent reputation you had for interior coachwork decoration. Now, who was responsible for that? That was your father?
Yeah, my father was.
He pretty much dictated the
that one there was built for the president of Montgomery Ward, and he wanted that woodwork in there.
Now, this is the
interior. How do you think the safety people would like to have all that hard wood around in there today?
Well, describe that in oral terms.
Well, it's hand-carved. It was not
the interior of which model?
Of that 166B, that one of Tommy Hitchcock's there.
The open, the all-weather
Yeah, the all-weather town car.
Okay, town car, yeah, okay.
He said he wanted it like this.
What was the president's name?
I can't remember.
Remember
up, right? He was not the fellow that was carried out by the soldiers.
Not Sewell Avery, yeah. His predecessor.
Not Sewell Avery. Was that the fellow that
yeah,
carried
right,
out?
Yeah, right, yeah.
No.
It was his predecessor. Yeah.
I don't know who that was and who really, what his name was, but we built the body up in the white.
Mm-hmm.
Doors worked, and doors were hung, and the latches worked, and everything. And then it was sent down to New York to a furniture carver by the name of Orsenigo, the Orsenigo company. They had an office anyway.
Can you spell that, please?
Orsenigo. They had an office on Madison Avenue. They were furniture
mm-hmm.
carvers.
Especially furniture.
Especially furniture, I guess. And they came up with that, and they put that in and sent it back.
Mm-hmm.
So we put the headlining in. If you notice, the headlining was cloth.
Yes.
And of course, the seats were cloth. And
what was that? What was the cloth?
It was a beige broadcloth.
It was a broadcloth,
yeah.
What are the differences, incidentally, between broadcloth, Wiese, and Laidlaw?
No difference. They both are made broadcloth.
They're all broadcloth.
Face finished broadcloth.
Because when I look at the records of the Lincoln cars in the 20s and 30s.
They were all the same. They were face finish.
You'll see Wiese, Laidlaw, and plain broadcloth.
And who?
And just plain broadcloth. I guess, but Wiese and Laidlaw, those are the two that you have to choose between in the broadcloth accessory.
Yeah, well, there was another one by the name of Yale Woolen up in Yale, Michigan, that we didn't buy from Yale, but Lincoln, when I got up working at Ford there, I found they were buying broadcloth from Yale. This was just when broadcloth was petering out and synthetics were coming in, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. But the interior appointments were especially opulent and very tasteful in the Brun town.
They were, yeah.
Yeah, right.
This is what they complained about, and what Wepner complained about, that they were expensive to execute.
Right, yeah.
No, I don't see
that's right. I have given it through. Yeah. Why don't you ask you something about those later?
You might get the idea that this was a one-man show, my father's one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
And then this other took that picture looking over the rear end of the Packard Touring Cabriolet to make sure that it was all symmetrical and everything.
Now, from left to right,
it's my father with the hat on.
On the right, he's the one in the hat and the vest and the tie, and Mr. Lang is on the left.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another German.
Yeah.
Craftsman. He looks somewhat like your father. They seem to be.
Well, a little
alike.
Bit.
Yeah. And they were the two who really made the company what it was. Yeah. You wanted to read us something from a manuscript book.
Well, just wanna.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's just kind of.
Please go ahead.
Forward. It is the intention of this narrative to preserve for posterity the life and accomplishments of Brun and Company coach builders of Buffalo, New York. Must not be confused with Brun's carriage manufacturing, carriage builders, also of Buffalo. The Bruns of both companies are of the same family who immigrated to America from Bavaria in 1848. The two organizations and their product are as far apart as the poles are and as the moving spirits that guided them. My father, Herman A. Brun, founded Brun & Company Incorporated in 1908 for the sole purpose of building automobile bodies and promoting the progress of this new trackless engine of great speed, the automobile. Henry Brun, founder of Brun & Company's carriage manufacturing company, was possessed to do everything he possibly could, as did other carriage builders, to retard and delay the progress of this new mode of transportation which was sweeping the world. This story of Brun & Company is by no means the story of one man. It is the story of an organization in which the course of its 33 years became one of the most respected custom coach builders of two continents. Herman A. Brun founded the company and gradually built the organization of skilled craftsmen, which made it famous. If his son's special recital of this history, it appears to be the story of one man, I shall neither help nor hinder it. I intend to tell it as it was.
Yeah, yeah. And that's you speaking.
Huh?
That's you speaking, of course.
That's me speaking.
What, before we leave the custom coach area, era, you had a, someone put together a show in Buffalo, which sort of celebrated the classic custom car business. You apparently had a well-known art museum.
Oh, Albright Art Gallery, yeah.
The Albright, A-L-B-R-I-G-H-T.
Yeah.
Was that named after a prominent family?
Yeah. John J. Albright, who was the president and founder of the Marine Bank, now known as the Marine Midland Corporation.
Marine what?
Marine Midland Corporation.
Midland, uh-huh.
But it was the Marine Bank.
And he founded that?
He founded that.
Was that one of the large, most influential banks in Buffalo, and still is?
Yeah.
I want to
tell you about
this. I didn't miss this. Remember, this is in oral terms.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The Albright Art Gallery staged an art and industry in Western New York exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
Run was invited to exhibit, but unfortunately we did not have a car close enough to completion in order to get it there.
Right.
So we called up Mr. Hatch. He said, sure, we want to be sure and be in on that. I'll call you back. I'll find out where there is one.
Right.
We called back and they found out that there was one on the showroom floor at 1710 Broadway in New York.
That was the Ford main showroom, wasn't it? Agency and showroom?
Yes, sir.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he said, we'll truck it up and we'll put it in.
Mm-hmm.
Our riggers will install it.
Hey, great.
Now, here's the way it got in there. It was one of the first times that, as far as we know, that an automobile was exhibited in the Gallery of Fine Arts, and lo and behold, we wake up one morning and it says Art and Industry in Buffalo at Albright Art Gallery, Buffalo, New York, March 6th to April 24th, 1922, first prize awarded for beauty of design and excellence of workmanship.
And this was the Lincoln Cabriolet
1932 all-weather cabriolet. Now, excellence of design is a matter of opinion.
Beauty of design.
Excellence of workmanship is a fact.
Definitely.
This is what we were quite proud of.
Now, this was an exhibit which forward-looking curator got together to exhibit products made in Buffalo and Western New York.
Yeah.
Now, were there any other automobiles on display?
The
Piercero was the other one. Of course, that was another monumental.
That was a Buffalo product too.
Yeah, leave those right there if you will for a moment.
Oh.
I'll look at those. I want to ask you about something. And so, you think it's the first time that an automobile was exhibited in a
Gallery of Fine Arts?
Gallery of Fine Arts.
We did at that time. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, the story that I've been noticing here is that you had a heck of a time getting it into the, how did that come about?
Yeah.
Into the actual gallery, how did that come about? Or the museum, I should say, How'd you get it in? You had to take it up the front steps?
Pardon?
You had to take it up the front steps?
You see the front steps there?
Yeah, I think I've seen a picture of it, yeah, right, yeah. Here's this gorgeous classic facade of a museum.
This is copied exactly from the Acropolis in Athens.
Okay, good. And the doors were not meant to admit automobiles, I suspect.
Well, it wasn't the doors, it was the Doric pillars.
Oh, the pillars,
the columns.
The width between the columns.
Those are Doric columns.
Right, yeah.
And when they got it up there with this block and tackle and everything, and the management and the curator was having a shit in his pants because he was afraid they were going to chip those pillars that they had brought from Greece, see?
Oh, my gosh.
And finally...
You're going up a ramp, an improvised ramp up the steps being pulled.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, somebody... I think that was my idea. I said, let's take the fenders and the running board off.
Well, that's how you did it, huh?
And that did it.
Uh-huh. That's incredible.
And it went in and it cleared by about an inch on each side.
Those really? Guys, those even guys, with the fenders and the...
Yeah, those guys were holding their breath.
Oh, my goodness.
But it went in that big room. It's what they call the sculptor's court, which, well, here it is.
Well, that's the front part. Let's see what you got in the inside. You talked about getting it through the front door. Got a picture of it in the sculptor's court?
No, right here. You just passed it.
Oh, yeah, right. But
no, this is going in between the pillars.
Okay. Here we are. It's inside. Okay. God, that was outside.
See, this was a sculptor's court, so it was strong enough, the floor was strong enough to hold a lot of weight. I mean, automobiles, see?
This wonderful Tom Cabriolet, 1932.
Yeah.
We were
quite proud. We got a lot of publicity out of it.
It must have been the hit of the show, wasn't it?
Well, we thought so, but I mean, there were a lot of other things like now Kittinger, a famous furniture company, is in Buffalo.
K-I-T-T-E-N-G-E-R.
He was one of the Kittinger's son-in-laws, was a neighbor of ours, lived right in the neighborhood there.
And he was a famous.
Kittinger's are still in existence, and it's very, very high class furniture.
Uh-huh.
And they had furniture there, and. Pierce Harrow had a car.
What was the year of the Pierce Harrow they put in there? What
the
year?
Same.
32?
The same time.
Yeah, okay, good, yeah.
And I have to laugh. Last summer at this time when they were getting ready for that big show down at the Art Institute in Detroit.
Right.
I can't think of the girl's name. Curator came all the way up here to, well, I guess she came all the way up at least to see me and other people too.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave her a booklet and we didn't even get a mention.
Not a mention?
No.
Nothing? No brun? Not even this lovely 32?
Oh, no, but I did give them a lot of information about how these fellas worked the thing out and getting it in, see?
Mm. But no mention? No mention?
No.
Have you seen the catalog?
Yeah, I think they mailed me the catalog.
They saved the century. Well, so that was, in effect, the high water mark of the Brun Company in terms of prestige and...
Yes, I think it was.
And recognition of classic coachwork and also engineering excellence.
Really, it's nothing but not an extreme design or anything, you know?
No, it's quite good. It's very tasteful. And it holds up. It looks good today.
Yeah, it looks good today. It's just like the Thunderbird. The Mustang.
Mustang, right. Yeah.
It still looks good today, you know?
Yeah.
It just proves that a simple, good design is going to look that way forever. I look at the Mustangs going down the street restored. There's a lot of them around here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, gee, there goes a good-looking car.
Right.
I had one, or Augusta had one, when we moved out here, and I sold it for $800.
Mm.
And out here, they sell them for $2,200 unrestored.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it?
But that's a great example of simplicity of design.
Right.
It wears well on you.
It certainly does. Yeah. All through the 30s, when things were flat, stale, and unprofitable, as Shakespeare says, you still had Mr. Edsel Ford continuing to give you orders, although somewhat reduced from the high point of your relationship in the 20s. Would you go out to Dearborn or out to Detroit to talk with him at all? Did you ever talk with Mr. Edsel Ford?
Well, we would get the message relayed to us from purchasing, or George Walker, or Henry Vesalius, or something, see?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now you're coming down to those 15 town cars.
Yeah, right. I can know a little bit about that. Tell us the whole story. Well, that's a fascinating episode.
He liked that. As a matter of fact, the original drawing was made by a fellow there in the studio in the department by the name of Ross Cousins. I don't know whether you've heard of him or not.
No, how do you spell that name?
Ross was an excellent illustrator.
Cousins?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
where was he?
He was in the design department then, didn't they? Mm-hmm. He worked for Gregory.
Eugene Bob Gregory.
Yeah, and he just made an outline drawing of this, and I guess Mr. Ford liked it, and he said, I'd like to have one made like that. And Walker called up and said, Mr. Ford wants you to make some of these, make one of these, and we'll send you the drawing. You'll have to engineer it, and mm-hmm. make it so you can build it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these illustrators didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's Mr. Kanzler's car.
Now, can you...
Mr. Ford's brother-in-law accepted originally. See, Mr. Kanzler wanted a trunk on the back. Very inappropriate on a town car, but mm-hmm. the rest of them just had a... I guess there was a couple others who had a trunk on the back, but that was Kanzler's car.
Now, this was, this was in a sense, if this is 39 to 41, a slight throwback in terms of a town car. Is it not something by 38, which was sort of...
This was a very formal, that's why I say the trunk is inappropriate.
Yeah. Can you describe in oral terms exactly what this looked like and how?
Well, this did not have any leather on the roof. It was all sheet metal,
mm-hmm.
and it was laid out so that they had sideward facing seats, which we called opera seats.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the sideward is called opera seats. Opera streets, seats.
Yeah, similar to like they used to have in the theaters that they'd flop down. He's over in the Paris Opera. God, what a fire trap. To get people in, they'd pack them in, they'd get them in your seat, and then there was another seat hanging on your seat.
On the aisle.
On the aisle, see?
Oh, great.
They could never get out of there.
So that's why it was called opera seats, from the Paris Opera.
Well, yeah, that's what I assume.
From Continental Operas, anyway. Yeah. Okay. And it had a very formal roof line.
Yeah, a very formal roof line. And
and had your famous cabriolet chauffeur's...
Canopies.
Canopies.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yes. Uh-huh.
That's an interesting thing about that canopy. Phil Hill, who I pointed out to you, who has that top up, that town car up there with the top down.
Where is Phil Hill these days?
Santa Monica.
Still in Santa Monica. What's he doing?
I'll see him in...
Will you? At Pebble Beach?
At Pebble Beach, yeah.
And what was his background again?
Well, he was the first American to win the world's racing championship. What do they call it? Formula?
Formula One?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In this
first and only one, I guess. No, I guess somebody else has won it since then.
Where was it? Where was it? Where was his championship?
I think at... not Cannes, but...
Le Mans?
No. What's the gambling place down there?
Monte Carlo.
Monte Carlo, yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. What year
Very
was that?
Winding.
Yeah, what year was that? Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but it was quite a few years ago, because
okay.
Phil is not as young as he used to be.
Okay, none of us are, I'm afraid.
Over here, the Saturday before the Concours de Elegance down at Pebble Beach, they also have some old-time automobile race cars drive around there, like Bentleys and things, and he's... He always wins the race.
Does he really? Now, what connection did Phil have with this?
Pardon?
What connection did Phil have with this particular?
Oh, he didn't have any connection, but when you put that box in the back of the chauffeur in order to put the canopy in.
To roll it up and,
It took up a little space.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
And we didn't do that on the Packards. And I can't remember why, but he likes that better because he says that the passenger sitting in the rear gets a better view, clearer view forward than when you've got that box hanging down there.
Oh, I see.
And I guess he's got a point there, but
we held
the material, the side parts, the side arms, and the material had to be taken off and put in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Now that cloth, that's fabric, convertible top material. Cloth had the top rail had a slot in there, and you pull that down in there, and then you drew it forward and clamped it on the windshield header so it couldn't blow out.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no restriction in the vision of the passengers. And he had a point, but...
But you didn't do that on the Packard,
We didn't have the canopy box, no.
We You extended it all the way
up. He got that car from the Van Nuys estate, you know, Van Nuys, California down there. Mm-hmm. Well, that was evidently, I just learned since they came out here, a very rich family. And when the Van Nuys estate was settled after they were all dead, he bought that car and
I restored it.
He does. He restored that car to something tremendous. I almost cried. It was so perfect. I mean that Packard.
The Packard.
He took the hardware, my father's own designed hardware and regulator handles, made out of bronze, and they stripped the plating off of them. And they stripped the plating off the door, off the remote control handles and the window regulators, and they bronze plated them all over again, and the upholstery was just excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And he drives that around town all the time down there.
You ever ask him why he didn't restore one of the town cars?
Which town car?
Well, of course, that. How many of these were built?
These?
Yeah, these.
These Lincolns?
Lincoln.
Yeah.
15. Now, how many of them still exist? Have you any idea? Have you ever tried to check?
Yes, I have, but I haven't. See, there's a couple of them. A couple of them were made in the limousines, if you want to call it, with a rigid roof over the front.
Yeah, right.
One of them was built for a Miss Louie Hall down in Rochester, New York. I remember driving down there with my wife. We'd only been married a few months, and she down with me, and I met the salesman down there. And Louie Hall, she was the sister of the inventor, is that the word I should use, of aluminum?
Oh, yes.
You've heard of the Hall aluminum?
Yes.
Well,